Hi, this is Dwight Gingrich. Welcome back to Was Jesus Okay with Homosexuality? This is session 4 of 6. This session is called Why It's Wrong to Say Jesus Said Nothing About Homosexuality. I originally shared this material as a blog post. The blog version of this session includes extra features, including 18 footnotes documenting my sources and adding extra comments. The blog version also includes an image and an appendix explaining how ancient law codes functioned and how understanding the differences between ancient law codes and our own Western legal tradition can help us better understand Jesus' statements about sexual ethics. To access these extra features, please visit www.dwightgingrich.com and search for the 6-part series, Was Jesus Okay with Homosexuality? Let's begin session 4. In this session, I want to challenge a popular assumption about Jesus and homosexuality. It's common knowledge that Jesus never mentioned homosexuality. That assertion is technically accurate based on our existing historical sources, although Jesus said many things that were never recorded. Yet, as I explained in the second session in this series, the fact that Jesus never explicitly mentioned homosexuality is a flimsy argument for saying that he was okay with it. In this session, I want to go even further. I plan to argue here that Jesus' Jewish listeners did indeed hear him speak against homosexual behavior, even though he may never have explicitly mentioned it. We've all seen it. That child who insists on interpreting their parents' instructions as narrowly as possible. Mummy says, "Don't draw on the wall," so daughter writes her name instead. "But Mummy, you didn't say I can't write on the wall. You just said I can't draw on the wall." Or daddy warns his children, "We have company coming in a few hours. Don't make a mess in the living room." The children all start heading to their bedrooms to play, except for one child. He tells his siblings, "Hey, Daddy didn't say we can't play in the living room. He just said don't make a mess. Let's get our blocks and cars and build a town over there in the corner." "I don't know. I don't think Daddy will like that," his siblings protest. "But we'll keep it really neat. There won't be any mess. We'll be careful." So the children get out their blocks and toy vehicles and stuffed animals. They carefully arrange an orderly town that soon sprawls across the entire room. Daddy returns moments before the guests arrive, surveys the busy living room with surprise and frustration, and calls his children to attention. "But Daddy, this isn't a mess. We arranged it very carefully," his son protests. What do his siblings immediately say? "It was his idea. We knew you didn't want us to bring our toys into the living room, but he wouldn't listen." Here's my point. I suggest something similar is happening when we suggest that Jesus said nothing about homosexuality. If Jesus' original Jewish audience could time travel and speak with us, they would say, "Of course Jesus spoke against homosexual behavior. We heard him plainly." What did his Jewish audience hear that we miss? What might we hear, too, if we listen as students of history rather than as combatants in a 21st century culture war? What teachings of Jesus might we be interpreting too woodenly? What did Jesus say that communicated his disapproval of homosexual behavior? I suggest there are at least 3 ways Jesus referred to homosexual behavior, despite never explicitly naming it. I'll begin with the most general and move toward the most specific. First, Jesus taught, "You shall not commit adultery." The Gospels record that Jesus explicitly cited this command at least twice, Matthew 5:27 and 19:18, as well as alluding to it on other occasions, Matthew 15 verse 19 and 19 verse 9. It seems illogical to our minds, trained by Western legal traditions, to think that "do not commit adultery" could also mean "do not commit homosexual acts." But that is exactly how many ancient Jews thought. We can perhaps begin to understand this way of thinking if we envision a Russian nesting doll or a matryoshka doll. Picture in your mind five wooden dolls, five different sizes. The largest doll could be labeled the Two Great Commandments. A slightly smaller doll that fits inside it is labeled the Ten Commandments. Next is a doll labeled pornea, or sexual immorality. Inside of that doll is a smaller one labeled aselgia, or especially shameful forms of sexual immorality. And inside of aselgia is a tiny doll labeled homosexual activity. In Jewish thought, the more general commands of their law, the larger dolls in this illustration, these more general commands implied other related and more specific commands, which are illustrated by the smaller dolls nesting inside the bigger ones. In this way, a person could sum up and include many smaller commands simply by citing one bigger one. Let's consider how "you shall not commit adultery" fits into this picture. This command was part of the Decalogue, or Ten Commandments. As the Encyclopedia Judaica notes, quote, "the Decalogue came to be regarded as a summary of biblical law." If the Ten Commandments were a summary of God's law, then they could also function as an outline, with each of the Ten Commandments serving as headings for other related commands. And this is exactly what happened. Some ancient Jewish sources classify the 613 commandments of the Torah under the headings of the commandments of the Decalogue. One person who thought this way was Philo, a Jewish philosopher alive at the same time as Jesus. Philo asserted that under the commandment, quote, "against adulterers," many other commands are conveyed by implication, such as that against seducers, that against practicers of unnatural crimes, that against all who live in debauchery, that against all men who indulge in illicit and incontinent connections, unquote. While discussing the Decalogue's commandment against adultery, Philo specifically mentioned several forms of homosexual activity. Quote, "The law commands that the man-woman who adulterates the precious coinage of his nature shall die without redemption. And let the man who is devoted to the love of boys submit to the same punishment, since he pursues that pleasure which is contrary to nature, wasting his power of propagating his species, and, moreover, being a guide and teacher of those greatest of all evils, unmanliness and effeminate lust. And last of all, because, like a worthless husbandman, he allows fertile and productive lands to lie fallow," unquote. There is evidence within the New Testament that Jesus and his apostles shared this approach to interpreting the law of Moses. Jesus, for example, cited the two great commandments, love of God and love of neighbor, and then said that all the law and the prophets depend on, or hang from, and are derived from, these two great commandments. Matthew 22, verse 40. Paul similarly suggested the Ten Commandments are encapsulated within the Great Commandments. Quote, "The commandments, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not covet, and any other commandment are summed up or summarized in this word, you shall love your neighbor as yourself." Romans 13, verse 9. Jesus seems to have applied this kind of thinking specifically to adultery. For example, Jesus, like some other rabbis of the time, taught a broad definition of adultery that included the attitude of the heart. Quote, "You have heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery, but I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lustful intent has already committed adultery with her in his heart." Matthew 5, 27-28. Jesus even expanded adultery to include actions that were contrary to God's creation design, but which had specifically been given loopholes by the law of Moses. Quote, "Because of your hardness of heart, Moses allowed you to divorce your wives, but from the beginning it was not so. And I say to you, whoever divorces his wife, except for sexual immorality, and marries another, commits adultery. Matthew 19, verses 8 to 9. Under adultery, then, Jesus also forbade other sexual sins such as lust and divorce. If we combine Jesus and Paul's statements, we could say that inside of love your neighbor is found, you shall not commit adultery. And inside of you shall not commit adultery are both, do not look at a woman with lustful intent, and do not divorce. And, Philo adds, do not engage in homosexual behavior. Robert Gagnon summarizes this ancient Jewish way of reading, you shall not commit adultery. Quote, the Decalogue commandment against adultery was treated as a broad rubric prohibiting all forms of sexual practice that deviated from the creation model in Genesis 1 to 2, including homoerotic intercourse. Unquote. Given this way of thinking about laws, it is likely that ancient Jews would have understood Jesus to be prohibiting all sorts of unlawful sexual activity, including homosexual activity, when he taught, you shall not commit adultery. This way of thinking is radically different from our own Western legal tradition. Our legal codes are exhaustive, and any action not explicitly banned remains legal. Ancient law codes, however, were paradigmatic, and people were expected to extrapolate from the examples given to all similar situations. For help in understanding these differences and how they impact the commands we're discussing in this session, see the appendix at the end of my blog post. How then did Jesus refer to homosexual behavior, despite never explicitly naming it? First, he taught, you shall not commit adultery. And second, Jesus taught against porneia. The Greek word porneia is found on Jesus' lips in both Matthew and Mark's Gospels. Jesus listed porneia among the defiling sins that proceed from the human heart. Quote, what comes out of the mouth proceeds from the heart, and this defiles a person. For out of the heart come evil thoughts, murder, adultery, sexual immorality there being porneia, Matthew 15, verses 18 to 19. Porneia is commonly translated sexual immorality. It is a broad term which can refer to every kind of extramarital, unlawful, unnatural sexual intercourse. New Testament scholar James Edwards says that porneia can be found in Greek literature with reference to a variety of illicit sexual practices, including adultery, fornication, prostitution, and homosexuality. Unquote. When Jesus spoke against porneia, he was speaking to Jews, not Greeks. What kind of sexual activity would Jews have considered unlawful or illegitimate? Would Jews have considered homosexual behavior to be porneia? We don't have to guess. In the Septuagint, the Greek Old Testament translated about 200 BC, porneia was used for any sexual practice outside marriage between a man and a woman that is prohibited by the Torah. That's Edwards again. Homosexual activity certainly fits this description. Remember the conclusion reached by Fortson and Grams regarding Jewish writings near the time of Jesus. Quote, Jews consistently condemned homosexual practice of any sort. Jews understood the Old Testament to speak against homosexual behavior, and they accepted biblical authority in matters of sexual ethics. Unquote. And remember how Keener summarized Jewish practices from the same period. Quote, Jewish people unanimously rejected homosexual behavior. Jewish homosexual practice was nearly unknown. Unquote. Given this historical context, Gagnon's summary is no surprise. Quote, in Jesus' day and for many centuries before and thereafter, porneia was universally understood in Judaism to include same-sex intercourse. Unquote. In fact, the related verb, ekpornevo, is even used in the New Testament to describe what Sodom and Gomorrah did. In Jude 1 verse 7, we read that Sodom and Gomorrah indulged in sexual immorality, and the word there is ekpornevo, a word related to pornea. What would Jesus' Jewish listeners say to us today if we suggested he never said anything about homosexual behavior? Of course he did, they might respond. We clearly heard him warn against pornea. How then did Jesus refer to homosexual behavior, despite never explicitly naming it? First, he taught you shall not commit adultery. Second, he taught against pornea. And third, Jesus also taught against aselgia. Mark includes this word aselgia in his record of Jesus' teaching about sins that come out of the heart. Quote, from within, out of the heart of man, come evil thoughts, sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, coveting, wickedness, deceit, sensuality. Aselgia is sometimes translated sensuality, as here in the ESV or in the New American Standard Bible. But that expression hardly carries the negative connotation in today's sexy world that aselgia apparently carried among ancient Jews. Lewdness, as the NIV puts it, or debauchery, like the New English Translation, come closer. While pornea was used widely to refer to all kinds of unlawful sexual intercourse, aselgia seems to have been used more narrowly to refer to sexual sins that Jews considered especially shameful. G. Thomas Hobson surveys the use of the word aselgia in classical Greek, in pre-New Testament literature, and post-New Testament contexts in his 2008 journal article, Aselgia in Mark 7:22. Hobson's findings are worth quoting at length. Quote, it's a word that Jesus could easily turn to as a synonym for homosexual activity and other similarly shocking behavior forbidden by the Jewish law. Aselgia was pornea taken to its most disgusting degree. The term may have been used to refer to what were regarded as the most shameless violations of the sexuality taught in the Torah. It would appear that the writer of Mark, writing for a general audience, saw a need to spell out an element of Jesus' teaching that addressed a sexual lifestyle issue among Gentiles, a matter that was less of an issue for Matthew's predominantly Jewish audience. Furthermore, for some reason, neither pornea, sexual immorality, nor mukia, adultery, specifically addressed the sexual sin he had in mind. It is likely that Jesus was speaking of violations of the Torah such as homosexual behavior, incest, or bestiality, rather than comparatively less shocking sins such as adultery and fornication. Unquote. In fact, there is one place in the New Testament, 2 Peter 2, verse 7, where the word aselgia is used explicitly to refer to the actions of people who were homosexuals. Hobson again. Quote, 2 Peter uses aselgia more than any other New Testament document. It links aselgia explicitly with the sins of Sodom and Gomorrah, picturing Lot, in 2 Peter 2:7, as greatly distressed by the licentiousness, or aselgia, of the wicked around him. Unquote. Given this usage of aselgia, what might Jesus have meant by the term in Matthew 7, verse 22? Hobson once more, quote, exactly what did Jesus consider to be utter shamelessness? What did he consider too far over the line? The danger is to impose 21st century AD politically correct ideas on Jesus. In context, it is far more likely that Jesus had in mind what his fellow Jews, like the author of 2 Peter, meant when they used the word. Images of Sodom and Gomorrah, images of outrageous violation of the one-flesh union of man and woman. If Jesus had wished to speak of homosexual behavior in his list of sins that defile the human heart, to what other word could Mark have turned in his translation? Pederastia, pederasty from love of boys, was too narrow a term. Arsenokoutes, or man-better, had barely been coined by Paul. And pornea, or sexual immorality, is too broad a concept, although it is the only word Matthew chooses to use in his version of Jesus' sin list. Aselgia was an ideal word for identifying both homosexual behavior and other similar sexual sins of which even the Mishnah was reticent to speak any more than was absolutely necessary. The appearance of aselgia on the lips of Mark's Jesus must be accounted for somehow, and it will not do to say that a word of such shock value as aselgia was a throwaway detail, or was intended as nothing more than a synonym for porneia, sexual immorality, or mucheia, adultery. It is argued here that, as he seeks to faithfully communicate Jesus' teaching, Mark found it necessary to emphasize to his readers that Jesus did explicitly reaffirm the Torah's prohibition of the most shocking sexual offenses. Unquote. Again, what might Jesus' Jewish listeners say to us today if they heard us suggest Jesus never said anything about homosexual activity? Of course he did, they might respond. We clearly heard him mention aselgia. And, of course, it is clear that Jesus' first followers did indeed understand that homosexual behavior was incompatible with following Jesus. Conclusion. A primary goal of this blog series is to help us interpret Jesus within his own ancient Jewish historical context. If we read his silence, his speech, and his actions as if he were our next-door neighbor or even a 21st-century rabbi, we are sure to reach conclusions that are historically invalid at best and dangerously deceptive at worst. It is frequently claimed that Jesus never mentioned homosexuality. That may be technically true according to our post-scientific revolution, post-enlightenment way of reading science journals and law codes, but it is also very misleading according to ancient Jewish ways of talking about laws and sins. Jesus' general language condemning sexual immorality would have been understood by his original listeners to prohibit all mutually recognized sexual sins, including homosexual activity, as surely as bestiality, pedophilia, incest, and many other activities he also failed to mention. Any ancient Jew would have concluded that Jesus did indeed address the topic of homosexual behavior. Jesus did so when he taught about adultery, even more so when he mentioned porneia, and especially when he warned about aselgia. Are you able to hear Jesus through ancient Jewish ears? Thank you for listening to Session 4 of Was Jesus Okay with Homosexuality? Session 5 is called Historical Conclusions, Was Jesus Okay with Homosexuality? This session will conclude our survey of the historical evidence of what Jesus believed about homosexuality, but will first evaluate three possible counter-arguments from the Gospels. Did Jesus say some people are born gay? Did he heal a centurion's male lover? And what about Jesus and his beloved disciple? I invite you to continue listening or to visit www.dwightgingrich.com to leave a comment or review what you just heard. This material is copyright 2019 by Dwight Gingrich, but you have my permission to share it if you do so freely and give proper credit. Thanks again for listening, and God bless your day.